And welcome to the Climate Minute, your source of insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre. Well, with the advent of the Joe Biden attempt to make electric vehicles the new important industry providing jobs throughout the United States, the idea of mass producing lots and lots of batteries for electric vehicles is, of course, now front and center across the country. We need to learn how to do that. Most people have heard, if they haven't consciously recognized it, but everyone's heard of a lithium-ion battery, a lithium battery. Lithium is an atomic element. It's very important to make batteries. You probably have a lithium battery in whatever device you're listening to this podcast on, right? Highly likely. But lithium needs to be gotten from somewhere. And the question has come up, whether or not the methods to obtain lithium to be manufactured into a battery, whether or not that extraction method is sustainable. In particular, the mining of lithium, among other things that are needed for batteries, is very destructive. I think the root question that we have been wrestling with through this series of podcast is whether or not we can build a sustainable future using unsustainable methods in the present, right? Destructive mining for lithium brings us to some magic world where we all have an EV somewhere down the line. Interesting question. There are bigger questions than my mind can wrestle with. So we are pleased to have to be joined by Benjamin Hitchcock Osceola, who is from an organization called Earthworks, and he is the Making Clean Energy Clean, Just, and Equitable coordinator, which is a noble ambition. Benjamin, thank you so much for joining us. How are you doing?
Great. Thank you so much, Ted. Happy to be here.
Good. So I talked a little bit about the need for lithium batteries and the concept that it can be destructive to obtain that lithium. Is that consistent with what you've seen in the world? Did I get that right or wrong? Or tell me the story of the things that you have seen as far as getting lithium to make your Tesla battery.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think it's important to note and to understand that, you know, so many technologies are very metal dependent, metal heavy, right? So it's not just low carbon technologies and batteries. You know, it's all of our infrastructure around us. And of course, you know, infrastructure for much less important and noble and positive and beneficial things like low carbon technology. So by no means does Earthworks want to only, you know, point out the issues with mining in the supply chain, but we do feel that it is very important to do this for a couple of reasons, to specifically discuss this issue for a couple of reasons. And one of them has to do with the fact that mining companies in recent years have started framing themselves as climate saviors. They've started framing themselves as sort of like heroes of the transition, because they have the ambition, or at least their marketing and their PR and their narrative frames them as having the ambition to provide the copper, the lithium, the nickel, the cobalt, the rare earths, so on and so forth, that are used in low carbon technologies like solar, wind, and batteries. And, you know, Earthworks a couple of years ago commissioned some research from a group of researchers at the University of Technology Sydney's Institute for Sustainable Futures to do an analysis of the supply and demand projection for the metals that are used in low carbon technologies over the next 30 years. And what they found was that it was particularly the lithium ion batteries that you just mentioned that were going to create the highest, the greatest rate of increase in demand for the metals that they relied upon, specifically things like cobalt and nickel in the cathode of these batteries and positively charged side of the battery, and lithium, which is, of course, the electrolyte. And the rates of projected demand increase for these metals are just astronomical. They're in the hundreds of percent, or even thousands of percent increase compared to current production, or in some cases, actually even current reserves. So what's actually economically viable to extract at the moment. And so this really raised a lot of alarm bells for us, because as Earthworks, as an organization that works on mining, it's been working in mining for 30 years, we've seen the really destructive impacts of hard rock and metal mining in the United States and around the world for all sorts of metals. So absolutely, it is a huge concern. We work specifically on lithium. We work with organizations and communities in different parts of the world, including the United States.
And I have a question for you. Can you tell me, you talked about hard rock mining, yeah. Right? For someone who's unfamiliar with what that means, what is hard rock mining? Describe briefly the process of what's involved there.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, there's different forms of mining, and I think, you know, many people maybe might imagine, small underground mining operations of centuries past. And of course, those operations still exist, and there are industrial scale underground mines. But largely today, what we see in industrial mining, really large scale mining, is these open pit operations, open cast mines, where essentially massive, massive, massive holes are being dug into the earth, or mountains are being cut and torn apart to remove huge bodies of ore, which are then refined and processed into a relatively small amount of metal. So you might, for example, I mean, you might 99.5% of what you might extract might be considered waste or tailings. So the term in the mining industry for mine waste, after it's been processed, the metal has been extracted. The metal that they're seeking to recover in the mining process has been extracted. What's left over is referred to as tailings. And these tailings are often mixed with toxic chemicals, which are used to extract the metal and separate out the metal from the ore. And then these tailings are very often they are dumped into these massive dams, these industrial-sized dams. And these dams can break, as dams do, as all forms of, as all structures have the potential.
A picture that I have in my head, tell me if it's right or wrong, but there's this enormous open pit mine, half a mile wide, hundreds of feet deep. There's a big backhoe digging up essentially dirt from the bottom of this mine. And what you're saying is that for each big scoop of the backhoe, 99.5% of that is just waste. And you're searching for the 0.5% of that dirt, which happens to be, say, lithium, right? And that somehow you have to have an incredibly aggressive chemical reaction to get that 0.5% of the stuff out of the dirt, right?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it could be crushed rock. Typically it's crushed rock, mm-hmm. And it depends on the grade of the metal that's being recovered. So, I mean, that example I gave, 0.5% is an example.
Right.
There are some grades that are even lower, there are grades that are higher, but generally speaking, the vast, vast, vast majority of what is being extracted, in the eyes of the mining industry, is considered waste material.
Right. I mean, there's no like pure white vein of lithium running through the dirt that you can dig up, right?
No.
Nothing like that. This is all sort of, in my understanding, is that's why it's called a rare earth. Not that it's rare on the entire planet, but it's relatively small in each scoop of crushed rock that you pick up, right? It is interesting. And so I guess, again, to my mind, the picture of what sounds like a scoop full of gravel has to be sort of chemically dissolved again to get to the lithium. So you're talking about aggressive chemicals, and then what kind of stuff have you got left over at the end of that, right?
Absolutely. Well, actually, to this interesting point that you raised about rare earths, so technically lithium is not a rare earth element according to the geological and chemical definition of rare earths. Mm-hmm. On the periodic table, there is a couple of lines of elements, which I couldn't name for you off the top of my head, which are considered rare earths. And they are used in other low carbon technologies, but they're not used in batteries. And so lithium is actually not considered a rare earth, although very often we see in the press, it gets referred to as a rare earth.
Okay.
And I think it often gets sort of mixed together in these discussions around the role of metals in low carbon technology. But just an important point for your listeners. But your point about it being rare or being perceived as rare is important, right? And lithium is actually very abundant. But you're right. It's that the concentration of lithium is quite dispersed, right? So it's very difficult to find what the mining industry would call a resource or a reserve. So a sufficiently concentrated deposit of lithium that could be mined. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And that brings you to the question of where are those So again, if we go back to the top level picture of the US government trying to encourage the production of electric vehicles with lithium batteries, all of a sudden, geologists who know where there's a relatively high few percent of lithium in the dirt or in the rocks, all of a sudden that place becomes very interesting to these corporations, right? Yes. So, I mean, where are those around the world?
Absolutely, yeah. So the highest grade concentrations of lithium are mostly found in salt flats, underneath the surface of salt flats, in what's referred to as the brine. So the brine is essentially very salty water, which contains a number of different solutes, including things like magnesium and boron. And, you know, if anyone's ever used, borax, the powder, for example, that comes from salt flat mining. That comes from, typically.
I'm old enough to remember 20 Mule Team Borax ads back with Ronald Reagan in the 60s. So there you go.
Well, there you go. So that borax is often extracted from salt flats. Mm-hmm. And from the brine beneath the salt flat. And so the largest deposits and the most sort of, from the mining industry's perspective, the most economically interesting deposits are found in places like Argentina, Chile, and Bolivia, as well as in places like Nevada and California in the United States, mm-hmm. And in different regions around the world, but primarily in those three countries in South America. And all three of these, in all three of these countries, these salt flats, it's very important to note, and this is also largely true in the United States, are on indigenous lands. Of course, all of the Americas is indigenous land, right. But in this, you know, in these cases, there are indigenous communities living very close by these salt flats. Many of them depend on the salt flats and the surrounding ecosystem for their livelihoods, whether it be harvesting salt or herding animals or carrying out subsistence agriculture in the surrounding areas. And so the interplay, so the real key thing here to talk about with the brine and the salt flats is water. Lithium mining in the salt flats is water mining. It's very different from what we just discussed earlier about hard rock mining. We can get back to that because there is hard rock mining of lithium being proposed in the United States, and there's a lot of it happening in Western Australia as well, which is very, very destructive. But I think it's really important just to explain briefly that this mining, this form of mining, what it does is it pumps brine from below the salt flat.
This is down in Peru and Chile, right? The method used there. Okay, yeah.
Second Chile and Argentina.
Getting the lithium.
Yes, yeah. Primarily Chile and Argentina, and then to a slightly lesser extent in Bolivia, but also in places like Nevada. This also happens in Nevada right now. The Silver Peak mine by Albemarle is an active lithium brine operation in the United States. And so what they do is they pump this brine from below the salt flat, and they decant it into these evaporation ponds. There are these artificially built pools, essentially, where the brine is poured into these pools, and the wind and the sun evaporates that brine, and it concentrates the salts down into a more concentrated solution, mm-hmm. and progressively they go separating out the salts based on density and through chemical reactions to arrive at a still relatively impure grade of lithium, which is then further refined chemically, right. To achieve to create the battery precursor that they need. But the problem here is that evaporation. That evaporation is taking place in some of the driest deserts in the world, and you know, regions where people everywhere rely on water, but much more so in deserts, right? And ecosystems and communities and agriculture desperately need reliable access to fresh water in those environments. And unfortunately, the science is very complicated and also very disputed, not in small part due to the interference of the mining industry commissioning their own science, which of course we see in all these industries, right? And so it's the interplay between the brine and the fresh water in these ecosystems is complicated, and it's highly debated. So I can't give a definitive answer here, but essentially the concern is that all of this pumping of brine and this evaporation of this water has a detrimental effect on the water table and on the aquifers.
Right.
So that's the primary issue, on top of the fact that these mines are operating without the consent of indigenous communities on their lands. Right. So it's a violation of indigenous rights. And so that's what we're seeing sort of across the board with lithium brine extraction.
Mm-hmm.
But then to bring it back to hard rock mining, in the United States, there's a couple of projects in Nevada which have gained some press and some attention. One of them is Thacker Pass, and the other one is Rhyolite Light Bridge, both in the state of Nevada. And they're both proposing, they're slightly different extraction methods, but they're not brine. One of them is a clay sedimentary deposit, and the other one is a hard rock deposit. But they both will use some substantial amounts of chemical reagents, acid, sulfuric acid, to process these materials, this ore, this earth, and create massive holes in the ground and destroy habitats and ecosystems, and disrupt the environments that they
and produce all those tailings. There's leftover stuff, right? And it's not unsubstantial amounts. From what I've seen, the descriptions of Thacker Pass are talking about thousands and thousands of gallons of water every day that they have to keep the whole operation going, which is pretty depressing. So we've got. So tell me, what's the we've got here in the United States? Of course, we still believe that we live under the rule of law, right? So there are perhaps more rules around the mining operations for lithium in Nevada. I think in the Chile and Argentina, Bolivia regions, there's a little bit more. I don't know what the right word is, but there's not as much protection for people, which is not to say there's much protection in Nevada, but probably less in South America. Are there any efforts underway? Let's start in the South America case. Are people pushing back against this kind of, I will use the word extractivism, right? That's kind of a buzzword, but what are people saying about it?
Absolutely. It's a great question. And just to address the issue of the regulatory context in terms of environmental regulation, both in the US and in places like Chile and Argentina. All three of those countries, if you were to speak to environmental regulatory representatives, they would tell you that they have some of the strongest environmental protections in the world. But it's simply not true. And the reality is that all three of the countries we just mentioned have, especially the United States, has a very favorable regulatory environment to industry. And of course, this was even more so the case under the previous administration. And that is part of the story of Thacker Pass specifically, is that there was a very rushed permitting process. But it's also specifically true for this class of metals. And this is another challenge that we've been seeing, is that due to this narrative around critical minerals, the idea that these minerals are also important for geopolitics and national security and all of this, there is a lot of political will to fast track these projects, and there have been executive orders from the United States government that have put an emphasis on the extraction of these metals in the United States.
Even Joe Biden has called for a review of the supply chain, right, for lithium, among other things. And that's a hint, right, that no one wants to mess around with the sage grouse anymore. We need the lithium, right?
Right, right, exactly. And that's we hope to, absolutely.
So I guess the question is tell me this story. What is what kind of regulatory regime? What should the climate hawk look for if he says, I want my lithium to be, pick your word, clean, green, virtuous lithium, right? What sorts of standards would you want to impose either in the US or wherever this stuff is being sourced?
That's an excellent question. I think that kind of goes to the solutions end of this whole discussion, which I hope we can get into more further. But I'll just mention now that there's a standard called the Initiative for Responsible Mining Assurance, or often referred to as IRMA. And the Initiative for Responsible Mining Assurance you know, Earthworks is one of the original members of this initiative. And it's important to point out that there are quite a few of these sort of mining industry schemes that focus on supposedly more responsible mining practices and offer certification and things like that for mining practices. The vast majority of them, I can say with confidence, are industry fronts. They're not reliable. Most of them are created by the mining industry themselves. They have very little oversight. They have very little participation from the communities, from workers, from environmental NGOs or human rights NGOs. IRMA is quite different. So IRMA is 3/5 of its steering committee is governed by civil society actors, whether they be from labor unions, from communities that are affected by mines directly, or from environmental and human rights organizations. There is mining company participation. There's also participation from companies such as electric vehicle makers. So you have companies like the Ford Motor Company, for example, which is a member of IRMA. You also have companies like BMW and Daimler-Benz in Germany, all of whom are making electric cars and are really concerned about their supply chain and the issues that we're discussing.
Right.
And so the IRMA standard is incredibly rigorous. We wouldn't have time to get into the details of it now, but it's you know, suffice to say that it is a very, very detailed and very rigorous standard, which sets out, in our view, the best environmental and social standards and benchmarks for mining operations. So what we'd love to see is the IRMA standard become law. We'd love to see, you know, at least elements of the IRMA standard become binding and mandatory, because currently it is a voluntary initiative that companies can sign up to, and they can be audited, and they can receive different levels of certification based on how they do. And they're required to publish all of those findings transparently. And so it's a wonderful initiative as it stands, but it doesn't have the strength of law. And we recognize that without it being binding, it will never have that power that it needs to have. That being said, there's also other initiatives. For example, in places like, again, in Chile and Argentina, there are organizations working on laws around water, recognizing, there's a whole debate about this whole brine water thing, right? Is brine water? Is brine not water? Is brine a mineral ore because it's being mined? How do we classify it? And that has huge implications in terms of how these mines are permitted and the environmental regulations on them. So there's also proposals specifically around these wetland environments, these salt flats. Specific protections around the salt flats and around and seeing them as wetlands, which they are.
I guess one of the first questions I would have is, do these, I hope you can come back, we can talk about IRMA in detail at some point, but I mean, presumably there is some mechanism in this IRMA, I-R-M-A standard to allow a voice to the local community?
Yes.
That must be fundamental, right?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
So it's kind of like this right of refusal for the people who, I guess you'd have to say, would be affected. And then beyond that, there you have standards about, I mean, presumably about, I don't know, what do you do with the tailings?
Absolutely. There's a lot of detail about how tailings are treated. And I should also mention that Earthworks actually has a whole separate campaign specifically about tailings.
Really?
Yes. So we have, and there's another report that we've published called Safety First, which is examines in detail how tailings should be treated. But
it's incredibly important, because that stuff lasts forever, basically.
Exactly.
Radioactive stuff in it, there's metals, there's all this stuff. It is toxic and poisonous, and it's sitting in an open pond somewhere in the high Andes, right?
Absolutely.
And it's safe if you live in New York City, you don't really care. But if you live near it, it's not a good thing, right?
Absolutely. And you'd be surprised, speaking of big cities, you'd be surprised how many metropolitan areas around the world, their fresh water sources are potentially contaminated by tailings. If there were a tailings leak or a tailings failure, there are many rivers around the world where there are tailings dams alongside those rivers or stacked tailings. And you know, if they were to contaminate those fresh water sources, that would be a serious issue for those cities. So tailings are a huge global issue. And I have a colleague, Jen Morrill, who could speak to this at length. And so
Let me, sorry for sending us off into left field there. We're talking about IRMA, And and standards of what people should be looking for when they buy their Tesla, right? And I guess I'll put words in your mouth. You can tell me if I got it right or not. But you go into your favorite Tesla dealership, Elon Musk is there. You say, Elon, is your lithium extracted according to the IRMA standard, right? That'd be something you'd like to see.
At Earthworks, absolutely, yeah. I mean, we strongly support the IRMA standard as as part of a sort of multi-pronged solution to this issue. So it's not the only solution, but it's certainly, you know, in the case where there is what we refer to as, you know, primary metal extraction. So metal that's coming from mines, metal that's coming from the earth, rather than recycled metal or secondary sources. We would absolutely like to see it be IRMA certified. And you pointed out something that I think is really key, which was about community consent. And this is incredibly important to the work we do. I mean, the biggest issue that we see, from my perspective, I mean, of course, there's all the environmental issues about mining, but these things don't live in a vacuum, right? I mean, you know, people are part of their environments and vice versa, right? And so, you know, there are special protections and rights that Indigenous communities have to refuse projects that are against their will or against their consent. So there's the right to free, prior, and informed consent, which is enshrined under the ILO 169, and that is part of the IRMA standard. So Indigenous communities have that right, and if a mining company has not obtained consent for its operations, then they don't pass the standard. They don't receive even, well, there's multiple levels of certification, but essentially they receive the lowest one. Mm-hmm. If they can't demonstrate that that FPIC, that free, prior, informed consent. And then for non-Indigenous communities, there's also there's also additional language on sort of community relationships and being able to demonstrate that those community relationships are positive. Mm-hmm. But we find, and this is really important to mention because there's hundreds and hundreds of cases that are documented around the world. There's a great tool called the Environmental Justice Atlas or the EJ Atlas, which documents mining and also, you know, oil and gas and tons of other extractive projects around the world, thousands of cases in total, where there are communities who are resisting these projects or are upset with these projects or being negatively impacted by them. And you're absolutely seeing this. You are seeing communities standing up and fighting back, again, in South America and in the United States. And this is really, really a key dimension to our work. It's not just about the environmental impact. It's not just about the water and the tailings and, you know, the destruction to those habitats and ecosystems. It's also about the people who live in those areas and who also rely on those ecosystems.
Well, I think that, so I guess I would summarize and say that for the people who I hope are listening to the show are probably very interested in renewable energy technologies, electric vehicles, whatnot, I would say that they should listen carefully to the show, follow the Earthworks website, which we'll talk about in a minute. But basically, I think people need to become conscious that the metals, these special metals that get into their special devices came from somewhere, and they want that to be sustainable. I think just asking that question, right? I mean, even if you forget what the IRMA standard means, I mean, if you're asking your, and it goes from everything, it goes from your Apple iPhone. I mean, there's lithium batteries you buy at Home Depot, right? I mean, where did that lithium come from, right? And it's probably not, you know, so just being aware. I mean, 10, 15 years ago, we used to talk about how when you threw the electric light switch on, you didn't know where that electricity came from. Right. Nobody cared. Right. Well, now people wonder if it's from a wind turbine or they're more sophisticated. I think the same thing is true going forward about these incredibly important metals. It's important to know the provenance, I guess is a funny word.
Yes.
But interesting. So tell me, Benjamin, if someone wanted to read the report, which of course I will put the link in the show notes according to from this page, but where would they go? What website would they go to look at to get this fascinating report about, I think it's about the mining?
Absolutely, yeah. If you go to earthworks.org, you can click on our campaigns, and then you will see Making Clean Energy, Clean, Just, and Equitable. And there you'll find a whole bunch of resources, including this report called Recharge Responsibly, which focuses specifically on lithium, nickel, and cobalt mining in different parts of the world. But you can also find there's, you know, a whole host of other resources that we have on this issue as well.
Super, super. So what we'll do is, Benjamin, I'll put up links to some of the stuff we talked about, that certainly the IRMA standard, which I'm sure is tied up in your site as well. But these other links we'll put on the blog, which is going to be at massclimateaction.org/blog. So you can go there to find out more. If you have a question about the show, you'd like to suggest new topics, please send us an email to podcast@massclimateaction.net. massclimateaction.net. Tell us what's good and what's bad, what things we ought to be talking about. You're probably listening to this show on a smartphone powered by a lithium battery. God bless you. But you can find the Climate Minute on any of the modern podcast distribution apps. Please ask all your friends to listen to us on their modern podcast distribution app on their smartphones. We want to thank our good friend D.R. Tucker for all his continuing research support. We want to close where we always close, by saying that we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, that we accept responsibility for building a durable future, that we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out. And because of that, we have to insist that the United States transform its energy sector over the next decade under a just and equitable plan that uses regulation, investment, and a price on carbon to safeguard our future. So, Benjamin, thank you so much for taking the time to chat. It's been fascinating.
Thank you, Ted. I appreciate it.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Very cool.